Hello again. We are coming to the third reading from the book, What is Man? Adam, Alien, or Ape? In the previous podcast, we examined the possibility that man is made in the image of the apes, that is to say, that man is the evolutionary product that relates us back to ape-like ancestors. And we came to the conclusion that that was simply impossible. So what are the alternatives? Well, the next alternative that is frequently advanced is that man is made in the image of an emergent spirit. Now, I once again use spirit simply to describe those categories of behavior and knowledge and mind that man displays uniquely. And I'm using the image terminology for consistency. So today we're going to consider the possibility that man is an evolved creature, but one who at some stage acquired a faculty that we call, that I have called spirit, a faculty that sets him apart from even the most intelligent of the animals. So here we are, let us begin our reading, and all will be explained as we proceed. The subheading is Man Made in the Image of an Emergent Spirit. In a spirited attack on the unvarnished molecules to man scenario, a British physician and neuroscientist Raymond Tallis sets out his opposition to much modern thinking about the nature of man in his book Aping Mankind, in Neuromania, Darwinitis, and the Misrepresentation of Humanity. That's the title of the book. The book is described on the flyleaf as a devastating critique that exposes the exaggerated claims made for the ability of neuroscience and evolutionary theory to explain human nature and consciousness, behavior, culture, and society. This is particularly interesting because Tallis describes himself as, quotes, an atheist and also a humanist, close quotes. But he completes the sentence, I believe that we should develop an image of humanity that is richer and truer to our distinctive nature than that of an exceptionally gifted chimp. Close quotes. Tallis makes it clear that he accepts neo-Darwinian evolution for all life forms except one, but underlines man's distinctiveness in the following terms. And here's an extended quote from the book. Humans woke up from being organisms to being something quite different, embodied subjects, self-aware and other-aware, in a manner to a degree not approached by other animals. Out of this, a new kind of realm was gradually formed. This, the human world, is materially rooted in the natural world, but is quite different from it. It is populated by individuals who are not just organisms, but inhabit an acknowledged shared public sphere, structured and underpinned by an infinity of abstractions, generalizations, customs, practices, norms, laws, institutions, facts and artifacts unknown to even the most social of animals. Close quote. Tallis then spends the rest of his 361 pages presenting his detailed case, arguing that the nature of man cannot be reduced to neurons and brain states, or explained as a simplistic Darwinian fallout. The key term in the last quotation is, of course, the expression woke up. It is this awakening that Tallis believes transformed mankind from being a mere animal to being something else. But as a self-confessed atheist, he is, of course, unable to credit this awakening to God, and must instead devise some wholly new and naturalistic explanation for it. He does make an effort to find such an explanation, and we shall see that later. And then his attempts to do so ultimately fail, and he is forced in his final chapter, entitled Back to the Drawing Board, to write, "Okay," quotes, "okay, you may say that you have told us what is wrong with the biological account of human beings, but isn't this only the beginning, not the end of the matter? Now tell us what you will put in its place. The truth is that I do not know, but I am sure that no one else knows either." Under the heading Conclusion, he quotes Jerry Fodor, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University, and an authority on philosophy of mind and cognitive science. Writing on the hard problem of human consciousness, Fodor admits, "We can't, as things stand now, so much as imagine the solution to the hard problem. The revisions of our concepts and theories that imagining a solution will eventually require are likely to be very deep and very unsettling. There's hardly anything we may not have to cut loose from before the hard problem is through with us." There is, of course, only one kind of answer that atheists can offer to the hard problem. That is the problem of human consciousness. That answer is that it has somehow emerged from the tangle of neurons, synapses, chemical fluxes and electrical impulses we call the brain. This alleged emergence process is often modelled by the idea, fueled by science fiction writers, that as computers become more complex, powerful and sophisticated, they will at some stage acquire consciousness and begin to match the minds of humans. But even if this were to happen, which is highly unlikely, it could only do so as a result of the labours, intelligence and ingenuity of human computer architects and software writers. Emergent consciousness isn't something that can just happen by accident. We will return to the question of human consciousness in Chapter 9. Well, then there is an alternative. The idea that man is made in the image of an implanted spirit. and that's different from an emergent spirit. Even those who side with King David in saying that God made man a little lower than the angels, even those who side with King David offer two very different scenarios. Special, that is, miraculous creation, or theistic evolution. The latter view subscribes to neo-Darwinian evolution and common descent, but insists that it was and is directed in some manner by God. In effect, theistic evolution holds that God used the process of evolution to bring mankind into existence, along with all other life forms, of course. C.S. Lewis describes one such scenario in the following words. I would add that it doesn't mean that C.S. Lewis believed this. He is just presenting a possible scenario. Quotation: "For long centuries, God perfected the animal form which was to become the vehicle of humanity and the image of himself. He gave it hands whose thumbs could be applied to each of the fingers, and jaws and teeth and throat capable of articulation, and a brain sufficiently complex to execute all the material motions whereby rational thought is incarnated. The creature may have existed in this state for ages before it became man. It may even have been clever enough to make things which a modern archaeologist would accept as proof of its humanity, but it was only an animal." At first sight, this scenario offers an attractive option, since it seems to sidestep the need for any physical miracle in the origin of man. It thus embraces the scientific claims of evolutionary theory, and yet thoughtfully keeps God in the loop, and avoids the philosophical bleakness of atheism. However, a little thought shows that the matter is not so simple. The God-implanted consciousness appealed to here would necessarily entail miraculous changes in brain structure and function. Otherwise, there would be nothing to distinguish the humans from their animal progenitors. And by rejecting emergent consciousness and substituting a divinely implanted consciousness, this narrative necessarily appeals to a non-natural process as the creative step that separates Adam from the apes. Small, invisible miracle in the brain might seem easier to swallow than a dramatic dust-to-Adam creation. But once any miraculous origin of man is allowed, it is hard to see what size has got to do with it. But this is not the only problem with the implanted consciousness theory. Firstly, of course, any arguments for or against the scientific validity of common descent apply equally to this idea, at least up to the point of implantation, and we shall look at these arguments in due course. Secondly, the scenario has somehow to account for the complete disappearance of the pre-human race, that in terms of biological development was indistinguishable from humanity. What with their opposable thumbs and tool-making skills, these pre-humans would have been endowed with huge evolutionary superiority over other animals, yet they died out, while less advantaged lower animals survived. Lewis suggests, of course, that fossil remains of these pre-humans would be physically indistinguishable from those of Homo sapiens, and would be mistaken for humans by paleontologists. But these human-looking but not human fossils should greatly outnumber genuine human fossils. So where are they hiding? And with such a close resemblance between humans and pre-humans, would there not have been interbreeding between humans and pre-humans to further confuse the picture? Again, we must look more closely at these things in due course.